Is Dune Part 2 the greatest science fiction film ever made? And maybe more interestingly, is it the greatest film about religion ever made? It brings together Frank Herbert's compelling source material with Denis Villeneuve's compelling science fiction vision, an incredible Hans Zimmer score, and a stellar cast to build on what was already a great start in 2021. It's certainly a great film for at least five reasons that I'm going to go into in this review, and I reckon it should be seen in the biggest, loudest cinema you can find while it's still in cinemas. And apart from being a pure spectacle of action and entertainment, the film does raise lots of ideas about religion and power and how those things go together that are worth discussing as well. So stay tuned to join the discussion. Welcome to Pink Door Culture Club, your eclectic entertainment guide with a sprinkling of amateur philosophy and theology, perhaps today a bit more than usual. My name is Jeremiah Burns, and if you like the show, make sure you like, you subscribe, you comment, and do all of those great things. The first segment of Pink Door Culture Club is called Spellbound, where we think about what makes Dune Part 2 so good. In the second section, we'll get into thinking about religion based on the world of Dune. But in terms of what makes the film great, here's five quick hits that all start with the letter S. And the first one that you immediately notice that's really present in so many of Denis Villeneuve's films is scale. This is a film that was shot in IMAX, and you notice the scale as soon as you see the landscape of the desert, of the caves. It's really reminiscent of Lawrence of Arabia in that sense, where the desert is almost a character in itself. You see it in the structures that are present in the film, so the palaces, the stadium on Gedi Prime, for example, the ships, everything's on this massive scale. You see it in the crowds as well. So the spectators at Gedi Prime, the religious gatherings in the desert, and the soldiers preparing to go into battle and then in battle itself. And it's actually these things in relation to each other that give you that sense of scale. So it's the relationship of sort of the structure in relation to the crowd that gives you a sense of how big the crowd is, because this is a big structure, but look at that crowd in comparison. Or it's the ship in comparison to the landscape, because that's a big ship, but look at it in comparison to the landscape. Or even the explosion, like that's a big ship, that's a big landscape, so that must be a really big explosion. And, you know, it's reminiscent of Denis Villeneuve's other work, like even in Blade Runner 2049, the city of Los Angeles, the outskirts of Los Angeles with all that farmland, that swampy kind of futuristic farmland, Wallace Corp, which is taken over from Tyrell Corp, you know, that all the corporate headquarters, the buildings there, the sense of scale. But it's also reminiscent of some other films like Lord of the Rings, where you have those epic battles, or a Bollywood movie I saw recently called Bahubali, which really reminded me of Lord of the Rings and has that incredible sense of scale. That's a sort of Hindu action movie, so to speak. It's a really amazing movie. And of course, you also see it in a lot of Marvel films as well, like The Avengers. I think it increases the power of the personal tender moments, because you switch from these amazing big moments to the whispers, the romance, these little personal touches are, there's more of a contrast, and therefore there's more power. They come to life more because they are put, you know, next to each other, or even sometimes within each other. Number two, if the first one was scale, number two is soundtrack. The soundtrack by Hans Zimmer. This is a whole body experience if you are in a big, loud cinema, which is why you need to experience it there. Highly evocative of alien worlds, of desert people. There's that real strong sense of the desert people. I watched a few videos about this, a few interviews with him, and he talks about how he deliberately avoided traditional Western orchestration. He said he grew up as a kid watching sci-fi films going, we're on an alien world. Why are we hearing violins and cellos and all of these traditional Western instruments? Let's go for something that would actually make sense in this world. And so you get him using these unusual instruments, these really unusual voices as well, which I think is super powerful, and unusual recording techniques to create something that, you know, is alien and really takes you into another place. And like I said, there's some great videos of him all over YouTube talking through and demonstrating the process and introducing you to the team of musicians who make that all happen. All right, number three is saturation or color. This is a film marked by different color themes. So the desert is a world of sepia. There's a contrast there with the blue of the eyes of the Fremen. Really reminded me of Lawrence or Peter O'Toole's eyes in Lawrence of Arabia. And I did hear Denis Villeneuve in one interview talking about how he was drawing on a couple of other religious desert films where Jesus is in the desert. Jesus is talking with his disciples, and there's a lot of that sepia tone in those moments. In contrast to that, you've got The Emperor's Home World, which is really lush and green. And then you've got Gedi Prime, which I think in terms of saturation or color is the most striking. That whole sequence on Gedi Prime was actually filmed with infrared cameras to render it in this completely alien, brutal, awful, surreal black and white. Now, it really, again, turns that world into a character in itself. And, like, it is visually striking. You are watching this black and white going, I've never really seen black and white like this before. This isn't Psycho. This isn't a film from the 40s or the 50s. This is, like, something completely different. And it's very powerful and awful for that reason. Number four, I've gone with the word sartorial, you know, like costumes or dress, something that's essential to building a rich world. And there is so much on show here, as there was in part one, from the beautiful to the strange to the grotesque. I went to an Alexander McQueen exhibition at the National Gallery of Victoria here in Melbourne recently, and it reminded me of that. Like, with that Alexander McQueen exhibition, you've got the finest dresses through to the most, like, punk rock sort of aesthetic type pieces, through to, like, things made out of garbage bags or shiny leather. You know, it was all there. And in a similar way, it's all here in June Part 2. All of the religious wear of the Bene Gesserit is especially, I think, interesting. All the various orders, the elaborate headdress, the other dresses that they wear to sort of show their religious rank or role. The Harkonnen, their shiny black armor, and the Baron, right? His clothing, his sort of black garb is really noticeable. And then the soldiers with all of their masks, which are like ventilators. I think, you know, all of that goes to make a really compelling world, and it's present in almost every scene. That the costumes really shine through in part two, as they did in part one. And lastly, the special effects. Yeah, only a few times I noticed, hey, you know, you can kind of see a bit of CG there. Otherwise, there's obviously some really great compositing here, which means it all feels really gritty and real. They're able to sort of integrate the digital with the real in a really beautiful way. And it's all driven by the story. So the wow is coming from the combo of the story and the effects, which of course makes for a much better movie than a movie that's just driven by effects, which is very, you know, bland and shallow. The ships, they're unusual, they're elegant. The explosions, again, like I said, the scale of those is amazing. And I think Baron Harkonnen remains, like, you know, a low light in terms of the place he represents in the Dune universe, but a highlight in terms of special effects, like his floating, his breathing apparatus, the bath that he immerses himself in. It's really yuck, but really compelling to watch as well. And then the action sequences, just like in Lord of the Rings, you've got those really long builds of character and narrative and story arc. That means that when we get to these big payoffs with worms and with battles and all sorts, you know, you really feel it. It's really exciting. It's really satisfying. And so to recap, what makes this film so great? It's scale. It's the soundtrack. It's the saturation. It's sartorial. And it's the special effects. The second segment of Pink Door Culture Club is called Rear Window, and the idea is to pause, to look more closely, to think more deeply about some of the themes or ideas arising from Dune Part 2. And these ideas are all about religion, because it's not the only thing that Dune is about, but it's a huge theme. It's a very strong theme of Frank Herbert's work and therefore of the films. And the first sort of idea, I guess, is of religion as a source of legitimate power and comfort. You really get this from the character of Stilgar and the Southerners, the fundamentalists, as they're called. For them, religion provides a source of identity. This is who we are as a group. It provides a sense of unity. This is the thing that brings us together with a common cause. It also gives a sense of hope. Even though our circumstances are hopeless, we have this prophecy. And so, you know, we can look forward. All is not lost. And it also provides a way of making sense of the world. So things are difficult. Things have been difficult for a long time. How do we make sense of that? Well, our religion provides a framework for that. And the film, like, is really clear that that belief is real. It's genuine. And not only is it real belief, it's grounded in real objective events that are going on in the narrative. But I guess the question in there is it just the way that the events are being understood and interpreted? So, like, yes, the faith is real. Yes, those events are real. Yes, it's providing you with a way of making sense of them. But is that all that is going on here? Like, it's just one way of making sense of things. I think that clearly in this world, the Southerners are seen as still like a little bit unhinged and a little bit dangerous as well. It made me think about the Western view that religion is, you know, really, religion is something we don't need anymore. And it's on the decline, which is a good thing, and it will soon be gone. And largely that's the view many of us have, because that's what we see around us, right? That's what you hear reported in the media and in the census. And that's what we see, like, literally in our families and our friend groups and, you know, our workplace and the culture around us. But it is interesting to stop and remember that religion is still a super serious, heartfelt feature of the lives of billions of people around the world. And I think there's a really interesting tension here as well for the West, because it's common for there to be that sense that religion is outdated, it's, you know, it's nonsense. We've got science now. We've had the Enlightenment. We can move on. But there's also that concept in Western society nowadays that we shouldn't say anything or do anything that's condescending towards people from other cultures and nations. And yet those people often take religion really seriously. Like, Christianity and Islam both continue to grow super quickly in Africa and Asia, for example. Would we say, oh, well, you know, they'll come to their senses eventually? Like, I don't think we would be comfortable to say that, right? That comes across as arrogant and condescending. Neil Brennan is an agnostic comedian with an interesting bit you can watch on YouTube where he points out that the vast majority of atheists he knows, and he's not a religious person. I don't think he's still an atheist, but his point is that the vast majority of atheists he knows are white. And he kind of asked the question, like, is atheism a product of a super comfortable life where you can't actually imagine the need to depend on anyone else? And you're like, I don't need an afterlife. Like, this life's pretty good. I know I work with and know and am related to many, you know, great atheist people who are very deep thinking, you know, genuine people with reasons for their unbelief. But I do think there is that genuine tension there between the Western desire to be done with religion whilst also never judging people from other cultures who are often very religious. And those people are not saying, oh, this is just a way of making sense of the world. Like, for them, often the beliefs are very genuinely held, and they would argue relate to some objective facts in the world that everyone should believe and recognize. There's also a question of whether Western society, which used to look to Christianity as a source, like the Fremen do, of, you know, identity, unity, hope, sense making, can actually do all of those things without religion. There's a Christian pastor, Mark Sayers, here in Melbourne, who talks about the idea of wanting the kingdom without the king. Like, Western society wants, yeah, we want love and peace and kindness and forgiveness and all of those things and truth, but we don't want this religious bit. We don't want this king who you know, Christians talk about, or this prophet who, you know, Islam would talk about, or whatever the religious concept is. Some people would say, yeah, we definitely can have one without the other. Like, we do not need religion to give us those things. Whereas others would say, well, a lot of our Judeo-Christian heritage is what has given us those things. That's the foundation. And so as we dismantle that, the fruits of that will actually be less available and less present in our culture as well. The book Dominion by the famous historian Tom Holland, who's extremely sympathetic to Christianity, although not a Christian, as far as I know, is basically him arguing from a historical perspective that Christianity is the power and the reason that transformed Western society from something that prized wealth and power and status and revenge and the oppression of others to something that prized love and humility and forgiveness and, you know, and the lifting up of others, the idea of serving others. So I guess if he's right, then less religion in the West wouldn't be a good thing. And ultimately, time will tell as the decline of religion continues in the West. A second thought from the Dune universe, from Dune Part 2 and its world, is of religion as a source of illegitimate power, illegitimate control. You see this in the Bene Gesserit and Lady Jessica to some extent as well, where you've got sort of stories being told and bloodlines being used as a way of meddling to maintain power for that particular group. From what I read, you know, Frank Herbert didn't like to comment too much on religion, but there was a constant theme in a lot of what I read that he'd had a pretty rough time with his aunties, who were extremely fervent Catholics and were always trying to, you know, hound him about that. And apparently he based this religious order on them. You also, in the film, have the character of Gurney, played by Josh Brolin, you know, basically saying, hey, religion is powerful as a way of mobilizing an army. Like, his advice to Paul is, who cares if this prophecy is true? That doesn't matter. It's useful. It is useful for this war. So let's just get on with it. Like, tell them whatever they want to hear. And you also have the character of Chani, who's kind of a form of local resistance. and sees religion as a form of imperial control. So her kind of, one of her big lines in the film is, the prophecy is how they enslave us. The prophecy is how they enslave us, which is why Paul is pretty reluctant to actually take on the role of savior. He's very conflicted for, you know, a large part of the film, because he's like, I don't want to manipulate these people based on something I'm not sure of, you know, something that I don't really believe in myself. At least that's where he starts, right? Now, even though I've said some nice things or raised some interesting, potentially nice questions about religion in the previous point, like, you know, it's fair to say, and it's undeniable, that religion is responsible for like some terrible, awful things as well, right? It's been used at various times to amass wealth through exploitation, to perpetuate abuse, to perpetuate ignorance, like the silencing and the shutting down of people who were trying to share scientific discoveries, for example. It's been used to unleash horrible violence and justify all kinds of horrible, violent acts. And I think part of what Frank Herbert is trying to convey in the books and what the movie is saying is that people should be skeptical of power. They should be careful and they should be skeptical of power, including or perhaps especially religious power. Here's the Dune checklist for bad religion. Some of these overlap. Just a quick sketch from the Dune world. Number one, it's opaque. The actions, the traditions, the motives, they're not clear to people. They're shrouded in mystery. They're hidden behind layers of you know, tradition and hierarchy that you can't really penetrate. Number two, it's manipulative. It actively meddles in the affairs of other people, including their families and their sex lives, to try and achieve an outcome. It's number three, focused on controlling others. In the case of Dune, like literally with the power of the voice, they can control others rather than seeking to empower others or serve others or build others up, for example. Number four, it's focused on maintaining the power and wealth of the group, no matter what the cost or the means, even if it means, you know, breeding with the Harkonnen, even if it means embracing them and you know, perpetuating their family bloodlines, for example. It's interesting that in the Christian story, Jesus has his greatest conflicts with super religious people, kind of along these very lines. He calls them hypocrites, who are more interested in outward appearances and traditions and control and personal honor than real love for God and real love for other people. So that's religion as a form of illegitimate control or illegitimate power. And then, like, a third and final point in thinking about religion and the world of Dune is power as religion. Power as religion. In the books and the movie, the Emperor, but especially the Harkonnen, represent a kind of fascist vision of power. All of the sequences involving the Harkonnen, especially the black and white sequences that I talked about earlier on Getty Prime, conveys that sense of them as awful, violent, selfish, greedy people. It conveys the sense that the only thing worse than religion as the source of power is when a powerful individual source of authority gains complete power and the nation state itself becomes a kind of religion. I mentioned Tom Holland before, the historian, and like he hosts, along with Dominic Sandbrook, another historian, a super popular podcast that many people would already know about and or listen to, called The Rest is History. And they did a series recently on the decline of Germany into full-blown fascism and the outbreak of violence at the start of that. And it makes for like really difficult listening. It was interesting that I noticed in that series, there were no advertisements. Normally that podcast is full of advertisements for all sorts of corporations and, you know, people trying to sell things, but this one was super sensitive topic, super dark topic. So obviously, you know, people don't want to advertise during that, because what they were showing was the slow, steady, but complete takeover by the Nazis of an educated, sophisticated society and its transformation into a hateful war machine. As part of that, they sort of show how you get that regime really co-opts every private moment and takes over or removes religion and makes it subservient to the state. I guess, you know, Bonhoeffer and others are examples of people who used religion and their religious convictions to stand against that whole movement in Germany at that time. And it's also interesting, and that's sort of a fascist example, but it's also interesting that even when it takes the form of communism, the outcome of a single human ruler seeking to reshape a society, even for supposedly good reasons, even supposedly, you know, to redistribute the wealth, for example, has led to, like, typically some awful results. Stalin's regime, Mao's regime, Pol Pot's regime. And I think, you know, communists might say, well, that's not really communism, right? That it's a corrupt, those things are a corruption of communism, which were, you know, it might raise the question of whether the ideal is actually possible. But also, I think Frank Herbert, from the perspective of June, might say, yeah, but it's good to be skeptical of power, even if the story being told is that we are going to take everything off you. And then what we're going to do is decide by committee together how to redistribute that on your behalf. I suspect Frank Herbert would be very suspicious of that view. The final segment of Pink Door Culture Club is called The Man Who Knew Too Much, where we run through some trivia or interesting facts related to whatever we've been looking at. Number one, Stellan Skarsgård's body makeup, that's Baron Harkonnen, took 8 hours to apply. 8 hours to apply and 2 hours to remove for every single day of shooting. That's 10 hours just to get into and out of his body makeup. He didn't drink anything at that time, and he took Imodium pills in order to avoid having to go to the bathroom during shooting days. That is some, it's no wonder that he I said before, his character kind of stands out when it comes to special effects, and it's no wonder, right? Like, that's some serious commitment. It's not just all CGI, it's actual body that he's lugging around. Number two, Denis Villeneuve said he will not release any deleted scenes, and he says, "I'm a strong believer that when it's not in the movie, it's dead. I kill darlings and it's painful for me. Sometimes I remove shots and I say, I can't believe I'm cutting this out." He says, "I think I'm very severe in the editing room. I'm not thinking about my ego. I'm thinking about the movie." These are long movies. So, you know, shows you that even with that, he's still cutting out a lot. And I think there were even two people who featured in the film and they cut them completely from June Part 2. They get a special thanks in the credits. But yeah, you can imagine their disappointment. The vision didn't incorporate them in the end. Denis Villeneuve described Fayed Reutha Harkonnen, Austin Butler's character, as a cross between a psychopathic killer, an Olympic sword master, a snake, and Mick Jagger. Austin Butler was offered the role while having coffee with Denis Villeneuve without needing to audition, and he trained for 4 months and gained 25 pounds using a fitness regime made by an ex-Navy SEAL. Definitely a scary character, definitely an awful character. And lastly, number four, Lady Jessica in the film, she has these kind of facial tattoos, and those tattoos are the Bene Gesserit litany against fear. So that's what's written on her face. Okay, so we are at the end of this episode of Pink Door Culture Club. Overall, I think Dune Part 2 is a masterful piece of science fiction cinema. It has, as I said before, an amazing sense of scale, an amazing soundtrack, amazing saturation or color. It's sartorial. The costumes are amazing, and the special effects really, they're really gritty and real and link in so beautifully with the story to create that sense of power and impact. And along with that, it's got a lot of interesting things to say about religion as a legitimate source of power and comfort, an illegitimate source of power and control, and also of power as religion as well. Well, if you're not familiar with Pink Door Culture Club, it's your eclectic entertainment guide, as I mentioned at the top, and you can engage with the show as a YouTube show or as a podcast. It's released usually every Thursday, Australian time. You can also engage with Pop Culture Proverbs, which is some short form videos released every Tuesday on YouTube Shorts at the moment. However you're engaging, do make sure that you like and you follow, you share, you comment, you do all of those good things. Great to read so many comments on the Taylor Swift video, and it's been great to reply to those of you who've commented there. This has been 10 weeks in a row at the start of 2024 for Pink Door Culture Club. So I'm going to take a short break as we head into Easter, at least from these long review videos, and come back to these in a couple of weeks. It'll be great to see you when I'm back. Feel free to be in touch, like I said, in the YouTube comments, via the Facebook page, or via pinkdoorcultureclub@gmail.com. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening.